This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Welcome to another in NHPR's 2016 Conversations with the Candidate series. I'm Laura Kanoy along with Josh Rogers. Our series continues with 1st District Republican Congressman Frank Ginta. Next Thursday, we'll talk to the Democratic candidate, former Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter. This hour, Josh and I will ask Congressman Ginta about some of the top issues in this race. We'll also present questions from our listeners received in advance on social media, and we'll hear from our audience here at NHPR, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network. We're also streaming on Facebook Live, so welcome everyone, and welcome Congressman Ginta. Good to see you.
Well, thank you for having me here, Laura and Josh. It's a pleasure, and look forward to the next hour.
We've got a lot to talk about, and I did want to start, Congressman, with the comment from last night's presidential debate that has been all over the news. When asked whether he would accept the results of the presidential election, Donald Trump said, "We'll see." Then today, Trump said he would totally accept the results. Pause.
If he wins.
Do these statements trouble you, Congressman Ginta?
You know, I've been asked this most of the day today, and particularly by the media. And you know, first, let me say I have full confidence in the election process, both here in New Hampshire and the United States. Sometimes I think people don't know whether to take Mr. Trump seriously or not. I'm not sure if he was talking specifically about the election process or some of the other complaints he's had relative to how this campaign has unfolded. But look, this is a democracy. This is the United States of America. We have fair and free elections. And at the end of the day, whether you like the outcome or not, we have a tradition of accepting that outcome because that is part of how our republic works. So I have every confidence that candidates up and down the ticket, both Republican and Democrat, will accept the outcome on November 8th.
Should Mr. Trump have said this? Republicans and Democrats, especially those who run elections in states around the country, are pretty upset.
Well, you know, every candidate runs the campaign that they think is the best way to win. You know, that's up to him. I don't advise him in that capacity. I certainly wouldn't have made that statement, but you know, he's certainly a different and unique kind of candidate. This has been a very unique presidential campaign. And, you know, from my perspective, we've got about 2.5 weeks to go. I think this is the time where people really, truly start to focus now and make decisions. New Hampshire tends to break late in their decision-making process. So I'm looking forward to the next 2.5 weeks and talking with as many voters as I possibly can to talk about the public policy initiatives that I've spearheaded and that people want me to focus on.
Unique is one word for it. Others have used other words, negative, dark, not as kind as unique. Why do you suppose a lot of Americans are just feeling so, well, upset about this election? It's taken a very negative, nasty, dark tone.
There has been a lot of frustration, I think, in the country in general with Washington, D.C. There has been a greater level of cynicism relative to politics in our country over the last decade, which is actually frustrating and disturbing to me. I was born in 1970. I'm 46. The first president that I really followed was President Reagan. And there are many things that I learned about President Reagan, but he drew me to public service. And I like to think of elections or elected office as public service. And I want the best from all communities to get engaged, to work collaboratively, and to try to find the solutions for whether it's your city, your state, or your country. So I hope that we get back to a time where the process is respected, that policy is the focus rather than some of the rhetoric that you hear and some of the negativity that you hear in campaigns. Because I think it's indicative or important to make sure that we encourage more people to participate, not less. And I think what the negative tone and tenor of campaigns does is depress the vote to a certain extent. And I don't think that's good for democracy. I don't think that's good for the country. And I don't think it's good to teach you know, the youth of America. My kids are 13 and 11, and they're old enough now to be aware of what's going on in politics. So at the beginning of the campaign process, my wife and I sit the kids down to talk a little bit about what we anticipate. We want them to know that they can certainly talk to us about anything that they hear or see or read, or if there are any, you know, other kids that make comments to them. But 20 years ago, you didn't have to do that. And I think that that's sad to a certain extent. And what drew me to politics was, again, that focus on service and trying to help and serve others. So I am an optimist. I hope that we can get better. The best way we do that is to try to conduct ourselves in a way that we feel is appropriate and reflective of what people want.
Go ahead, Josh. I'll turn it over to you.
So, Congressman, from the start of this campaign, you've stressed your work across the aisle, and you invoke Ronald Reagan, who's somebody of principle but capable of cutting deals and being respectful of political opponents. Yet at the same time, you've aligned yourself with Donald Trump more closely than any local Republican incumbent in any consequential office. You know, his message is hardly that. I mean, how do you square that?
Well, this election is about the people of the state of New Hampshire. You know, we have a binary choice between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton relative to the presidential. And while I think and join a lot of people in their frustration with the choices overall, when you look at the negativity that people feel of either candidate, they're both very high. And I think that that adds to the disappointment in the choices. But these are the choices that America has to make. Separate from that, you know, once I got elected to this term, I've always said there's a time to campaign and there's a time to govern. And I got to work immediately, put my head down and focused on the issues that I thought were most critical to New Hampshire and the country. And what I felt in divided government and in this divided government going into a presidential campaign, I felt the most effective thing that I could do are impact the issues that are most closely related to home, the fishing industry, Great Bay and the EPA regulatory issues that they're having, the heroin and opioid crisis. I'm one of the few Republicans in Congress that can say they got six pieces of legislation signed into law by this president. I have the ability and the willingness to work with Republicans and Democrats, regardless of our ideology, because I think it's important to put people over politics, and it's important to focus on the public policy that you feel can be most beneficial. And I've demonstrated that. When it comes to the choice in November 8th, that's what I think people do want. I think more often than not, people will look at the individual, the things that they accomplish, how they approach a position and a job, rather than just the party affiliation. Now, I don't know if that'll be the case at the presidential level, but I can tell you more, even though I'm running for the House of Representatives, I consider that more local. People know who I am. I'm talking about just my district in New Hampshire. And I think people get a sense of how I've approached things. So I think over the next 2.5 weeks, that's what we'll continue to talk about.
So we're going to get to some of those issues in a minute, but one more political question.
Sure.
You know, when you announced for re-election this year, you know, a lot of people thought you were essentially a goner. Leaders in your party had sought your resignation after you settled with the FEC for illegal campaign contributions. And they did that mainly because they felt you'd been less than truthful about this whole thing. Obviously, you made it through the primary, but one upshot of that seems to be, you know, weak local fundraising. And the money that you're getting these days seems to be predominantly from lobbyists and political action committees. Is that something that local voters should be concerned about as they, you know, consider your representation of the first district?
You know, I remember my first campaign for state representative in New Hampshire, and I was a Republican in one of the most Democrat wards in Manchester. And I was told, Frank, why are you running? You can't win. Just look at the numbers. And I put that comment aside, and I focused my attention on doing my job. And lo and behold, I won. And then I was told when I was running for alderman that, Frank, you're running in a Democrat ward. You're not going to win. So don't even try. And lo and behold, I won. And then I was told the same thing when I ran for mayor. The passion and conviction in my heart is what drives me. I have supporters of all stripes and sizes. I appreciate that financial support because people believe in the focus and attention that I bring to issues. But the financial resources don't guide the principle of policy for me. So I would certainly love it, Josh, if you wanted to contribute to the campaign and get more New Hampshire donors. But the reality is we are a grassroots state where I think money is not the sole determining factor of whether you can win or lose a race. If that was the case in 2014, I was outspent $10 million to $5 million. And by that metric, I should not have won, but I was the only Republican to win and get crossover votes from independents and Democrats. And I think it's because of the approach that I've taken as mayor and as a member of Congress.
Well, let me remind everybody that you can also join us with an email at exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at NHPR Exchange. It's our Conversations with the Candidates series today on NHPR. Congressman Frank Ginta is here, Republican from the 1st District. We're taking questions from our audience here at NHPR and also presenting some questions that came in earlier this week on social media. And Congressman Ginta, I want to ask you one of those questions that came in yesterday. This person asks, what's your stance on Citizens United? Has dark money affected campaigns, yours included, too much? And again, I want to thank that person for submitting the question.
Sure. Look, I think the most important thing for the financial side of running elections is transparency. The more transparency there is in who's contributing to individuals, where anybody can see that, I think is a benefit. I have certainly been on the receiving end of outside PACs and super PACs spending money against me, where I have no idea who they are. I have no idea who's contributed to those PACs, and probably most people in New Hampshire, in that 8 seconds that you see the tiny, tiny print at the end about who it's paid for by, have no clue.
Have we lost control of the political process given the influence of these groups?
You know, Laura, I hope not. This is why, though, I think it's imperative to campaign effectively, to remind people of the policy positions that you hold. And in New Hampshire, we're fortunate that we have an electorate that's engaged. We have an electorate that, on a higher percentage than most other states, participates in the electoral process.
Some candidates this year are saying they would work to overturn Citizens United. Now, that's difficult. It's a Supreme Court decision, not a congressional decision. But is that something that you would support or oppose?
Well, it is there's a separation of powers.
Right.
So the
Understood.
Legislative branch doesn't have any authority or ability to impact that. What I can impact is disclosure of the contributions that we receive, which obviously we do, and as every candidate does, by the way. And I hope that at the end of a campaign, that people will ultimately do their level best to try to find out where the candidates stand, and that the candidates do their level best to communicate. That's part of what an open process in New Hampshire should be. And to that point, in the state of New Hampshire right now, you know, I'm running against somebody that I think probably most people are familiar with, in former Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter. She's been running since 2006. But there's another gentleman, Sean O'Connor, who is running. He was running in the Democratic primary. He was not treated fairly by the leadership in the Democratic Party, so he decided to run as an independent in the general election. He's on the ballot. The Democratic leadership the leadership in the Democratic Party tried to kick him off the ballot, and now there's discussion about whether he's not going to be allowed into debates. That's not the New Hampshire way. That's not access to candidates, and he's a pretty credible candidate based on the amount of money that he's spending and the type of campaign he's running.
Speaking of access to candidates, we've got some people in our audience here in Studio D at NHPR, so let's go to one of those. Thank you for coming out tonight. Go ahead and ask your question.
Hi, thank you for being here. My name's Annika Stanley-Smith, and I'm from Goffstown. I'm a young professional that works in the prevention field, and we do a lot of great work here in New Hampshire with minimal funding, but we know we need more. What would you do to ensure that CARA is fully funded?
So thank you very much. CARA is the federal legislation that we passed earlier this year, the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act. So we have started the funding in September in this continuing resolution. It's $192 million a year for each of the next 5 years. And the CARA legislation is critically important for several reasons. We have a serious heroin and opioid crisis in the state of New Hampshire. We had 439 deaths last year. We're unfortunately on track to meet or exceed that number this year. Thousands of people are overdosing on a regular basis and need assistance. I serve as the chairman of the Congressional Task Force, the bipartisan task force to combat the heroin and opioid crisis. I chose Annie Custer, Democrat from the 2nd Congressional District, as my co-chairman. That's not done that often, by the way, in Washington. But I went to my leadership and said, here's how I think we should progress relative to this issue, people over politics. And my leadership agreed. And now we have almost 90 members equally divided amongst Republicans and Democrats on that committee. And why is that important? Because any time that we need to focus on this issue legislatively, we've got a solid group of at least 90 members that right off the bat have a fundamental agreement on how we can assist in this crisis.
So how does the CARA money help, and was that supported? Was that passed?
So that was passed bipartisanly. It was one bill in the Senate. It was opened up to 18 different pieces of legislation in the House, went through committees of jurisdiction. Our task force made recommendations as to each and every component of those pieces of legislation and modified them a little bit. We went to committee of conference with the Senate, but in the House, by the way, all 18 bills were passed bipartisanly. And I do have to say New Hampshire media did a pretty good job of communicating this in New Hampshire, but national media almost gave this no attention. Now, there was a lot of attention to the crisis, 60 Minutes, I think it was 20.
They came to Manchester, one of them.
But there were national stories about the crisis. But there was almost no national news when Congress came together bipartisanly and passed this bill, signed into law by the president, and the funding started in September.
But do you think there's enough funding? Obviously,
The first step.
Senator Shaheen called for $600 million, I believe, in emergency funding. That didn't happen. Do you think that
the emergency funding didn't happen, but we had passed $500 million last year in the omnibus, and this is $192 million a year for the next 5 years. So we're on track to actually exceed that number. But this is step number one. We had a press conference, members of Congress, when we got this signed into law by the president, saying this is step one. There are more things that Washington will do. The main focus of this bill is treatment and recovery, money for pregnant women who are addicted, veterans who are addicted, unfortunately, because of the pain management requirements for them, and then education money. We unfortunately have to talk to our students and children about the severity of heroin and of fentanyl, particularly heroin laced with fentanyl. But then there's also the public safety component. The biggest crisis I think we're seeing in New Hampshire is twofold. We don't have enough drug and recovery courts, and we don't have enough beds.
So will this money help New Hampshire set up
drug courts
that
yes,
state lawmakers say
actually,
they want?
I actually wrote the amendment for an additional $5 million for drug courts, and we got that amendment passed. There is $5 million available today for any community or county in the state that wants to go access that money.
I want to ask you very quickly, Congressman Ginta, about Attorney General Joe Foster, who has said he's investigating whether legal action against the pharmaceutical companies is worth pursuing, given their role, he says, in aggressively marketing these opioid painkillers. Is that a good idea?
Well, without having looked at either state law, I don't know what law off the top of my head would be that they would be in violation of. That being said, I was a little offended, quite honestly. I'm a football fan. When I was watching the Super Bowl, there was an ad during the Super Bowl about a prescription. If you were having issues with your opioid, you could take this prescription to address that challenge that you were having with an opioid. That to me wasn't trying to solve the problem of opioid addiction. And it wasn't until presidential candidates in New Hampshire started getting questions by residents of New Hampshire where the nation started really addressing this issue.
The issue came to light. Well, coming up, we will talk more with Congressman Frank Ginta in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Welcome back to our Conversations with the Candidates series on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Our guest is 1st District Congressman Frank Ginta, a Republican from Manchester. Next Thursday, we'll talk with his Democratic challenger, former Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter. We're also taking questions from our audience, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network, as well as those submitted in advance on social media. You can join us, too, by email at exchange@nhpr.org or on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Congressman, just before the break, we were talking about the opioid crisis, and Anika in our audience asked about federal money for prevention and so forth. Then I asked you about Attorney General Joe Foster's idea to possibly investigate legal action against the drug companies for overly aggressively marketing these products. And you want to finish up that thought. Go ahead.
I did. So I think it's not only the physicians who are prescribing who need to play a role in fixing this. And we have reached out to physicians in the state of New Hampshire and so far are trying to play a positive role. But we have already started to reach out, Ann Custer and I, to the pharmaceutical companies, because there is a wide nexus between an ibuprofen pill and an opioid. There's almost nothing in between. And I'd like to, you know, look, we do rely on pharmaceuticals.
For pain, you mean?
Exactly, for pain. We do rely on research and development to find life-saving drugs, and we want to continue that. But in this space, the fact that there is such a gap between an ibuprofen and an opioid is unsettling to me, at the very least.
So people need more options for
dealing
with pain.
Well, I think they do need more options. I mean, think of it this way. 4 out of 5 opioids prescribed worldwide are prescribed here in the United States. That tells you something about the medical approach that we are taking to pain management, which is very, very different than other parts of the world.
Well, huge issue. And again, thank you, Anika, for bringing it up. And Josh, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay, why don't we talk about water quality? Let's talk about drinking water. In District 1, residents in Merrimack and the surrounding area are obviously quite worried about contaminants these days, high levels of the chemical PFOA, which is linked to serious illness, including cancer. Plastics plants owned by Saint-Gobain is blamed for this, and some say Congress is also partially responsible for serially blocking regulations that might have allowed investigation of health risks into PFOA. Do you believe that's a fair critique?
I'm not sure that is a fair critique. I mean, I meet with Kurt Spaulding, the EPA Region 1 director, on a fairly regular basis between our conversations and our meetings. He and I have a good relationship. I can tell you he spends a lot of time looking to regulate in New Hampshire and in Region 1 in general. I do think that the state of New Hampshire does a pretty good job of self-regulation. Saint-Gobain seems to be in a position where they are trying to be responsible and be proactive. I want to continue to obviously see that. So we mitigate any exposure to any resident. But I also think it's fair and reasonable and responsible to test other areas, which has been happening, to make sure that the PFOA levels in other parts of the state aren't above normal or accepted levels. So at this point, and by the way, EPA doesn't need an invitation to come to New Hampshire. I mean, they're here on a regular basis. If they feel that they have a role to play, they will play it. But I'm satisfied with how the state of New Hampshire has been handling this, and I want to make sure, it appears from what I've been told, that Saint-Gobain is cooperating and that they want to try to mitigate whatever exposure there is to people, not just in the town, but in the region.
So you don't necessarily believe that Congress has a role to play in spurring increased action on this front?
I don't think it's necessary at this point because of the fact that the state of New Hampshire has been, I think, rather appropriately, has taken appropriate action. And so in my view, at this point, there hasn't been a need for congressional action.
Okay.
Did you want to follow up, Josh, on the other water issue? Okay, well, turning back to Social Security then, Congressman Ginta, and you said in 2010 when you were first running that you'd like to pull together a bipartisan group, if elected, where everyone, I'm quoting you now, sets their politics aside on Social Security, finds a way to make it solvent. Again, that was back in 2010. What happened?
So I got to the added to the Budget Committee, and that first year, we decided to try to tackle Medicare first. And we put a plan together in the Budget Committee that ended up, unfortunately, being considered a rather partisan approach to solving Medicare, despite the fact that it was largely taken from then-President Bill Clinton and his administration. And it became a political issue in the country at that time. And I was criticized rather harshly for trying to solve the problem because of the solution that we proposed.
This was the so-called Medicare vouchers.
This was premium support. Well, some would call it vouchers. I would call it premium support.
So Social Security got lost in the sauce.
Well, it didn't get lost in the shuffle. We focused first on Medicare. When we couldn't pass it in the first year, the second year, we went back, worked with Democrat Senator Rot Wyden to try to modify the plan a little bit, to try to bring some bipartisanship to it. And again, all of the focus and attention became political on Medicare. And then by the end of that term, no one ever got to Social Security. And then, unfortunately, for me, I wasn't reelected in that next term. So, you know, I got back to Congress in 2014, and most of my time at this point have been spent on the heroin and opioid crisis.
So couple fixes that are often talked about, Congressman Ginton. I'd love to get your thoughts as to which ones you could get behind. Here's a few. First of all, raise the Social Security income tax cap. Right now, as you know, any income above roughly $120,000 is untaxed for Social Security. Some people say this is a way to both better fund the system and make it more fair. What do you think about that?
So I watched the debate last night, and I heard Secretary Clinton say that she would not raise taxes on any individual or family making under $250,000. And then later in the debate, she supported that notion of increasing that cap. Well, increasing that cap does provide a tax increase to every individual working in America. I don't know that that's necessarily the best way to do it. By the way, that cap does get adjusted annually already. I think we need to look at a bit of a different approach. When Social Security first was created, the life expectancy was essentially the same date that you were going to first start receiving benefits.
In your early 60s.
So, yes. So that obviously has now changed. First, let me say, to be clear, I think Social Security is a program that's valuable, that should stay, and I think we need to preserve and protect it. And any changes that are made by the next Congress or future Congresses, in my view, first should not impact existing seniors who are recipients or people near the retirement age, simply because you're relying on that money as part of your retirement plan. But I think for future recipients, and I can use myself as an example, who I'll be in the workforce, you know, at least another 25 years. If the date by which I receive Social Security changes by 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 months in order to preserve and protect Social Security, I'm willing to give up those dollars.
So that's a vote for raising the retirement age?
Let me say, I think you got to have everything on the table, and you got to have a bipartisan group that's going to negotiate this. But I think there's an opportunity to adjust the age at which somebody receives it for people who are my age or younger, because of the life expectancy factor. That in and of itself, and you don't even have to change that date by much. I mean, we're not talking years, we're talking months. And that would do a lot to shore up Social Security for the next 70 or 80 years. If nothing is done, by the way, this is insolvent in the 2030s, 2020s, 2030s, and same thing with Medicare. No, I hope nobody wants to see that, because now you would be talking about an across-the-board 25% cut for existing recipients. That, I think, would be a disaster. So my hope is that Congress says this is no longer the third rail of politics. Get to work and find that solution that's in the best interest of ratepayers, people who are paying into it, and then the people who are obviously receiving the benefit.
Well, good luck getting that group together, because it is the third rail of politics, as you know.
But it shouldn't have to be.
So one more option that often comes up, Congressman Ginton, I know you know this, when we talk about Social Security. Some people say, let's put some portion of Social Security into private savings accounts for greater returns, especially for younger people. This has been talked about for a long time, but has been politically difficult.
It has been politically difficult, because what I have found, if somebody takes the position that they support that, the other side of the aisle will immediately say you're for privatization. And I don't think that that's a fair assessment. Let's say we come up with a plan that is voluntary, where an individual can make the choice to keep 100% of their benefit with the federal government, or if maybe they want to take, at their own choice, a certain percentage and invest it somewhere else. That's something that has been discussed and maybe has some viability. And I think that that's worthy of discussion. But at the end of the day, things like that don't often get that far because the politics of a campaign gets injected into that issue almost immediately. And that's part of the issue going back to the super PAC money or the dark money, where you don't know where that money is coming from. That sometimes has an impact on the progress that I think needs to be made legislatively on some of these core issues.
So again, to be clear on Social Security, raising the retirement age sounds like maybe a little.
I think there's some room there to move it a few months, for younger individuals.
Private accounts sounds like maybe, but it's tricky given
it's in discussion right now. I'm not sure if it would make it into the next reform, but I think as you continue to talk about it, that might be a voluntary option at some point down the road.
And raising that tax cap on Social Security income right now, again, anything above $120,000
isn't. I would keep it at the current levels that have automatic increases. I wouldn't consider looking at increasing it over and above that, primarily because you're in an economic situation right now where you have 1% GDP growth. Remember, the employee and the employer is paying for that. And the apolitical report that came out of Washington, D.C., was that anywhere from 900,000 jobs would be lost if that happens. I want to create an economy where there's job growth, where there's upward mobility, where employers, there's greater competition amongst employers for employees, so wages are going up naturally as opposed to a forced regulatory approach.
What about means testing? That's sometimes
that's out. Something that's been discussed, and I think is possible to be part of the solution. Now you'd have to figure, okay, what I mean, if you have a net worth of X, you would receive theoretically in means testing a lower benefit or no benefit. That is a discussion, and I think it's worthy to have that discussion because we really want to focus on the people that are most of need. But now you have to figure out where is that net worth cap going to be? I mean, I think it would probably be placed rather high, but that still could create some savings for the long-term viability of Social Security.
All right, let's move to another thorny one: national security and combating terrorism. Here's a little clip of what you said the last time you participated in one of these candidate forums back in 2014.
I believe that there needs to be a war vote based on the War Powers Act. I think what is happening in Iraq and Syria fits the definition of war. And at the very least, the United States of America should take the vote.
Okay. That was you 2 years ago on Iraq and Syria. This week, Iraqi forces began an offensive to retake the city of Mosul, which had been a stronghold of the Islamic State. The U.S. is participating with artillery, intelligence advisors, and troops calling in airstrikes. What's at stake there as far as you see it?
Well, today an American soldier was killed. So what's at stake continues to be American life. And when I made the statement that you just played 2 years ago, my sentiment hasn't changed. When you are authorizing the use of military force, you're talking about putting American lives in danger. And I think that that's a very serious decision that needs to be made and needs to be made via a vote. Now, the existing authorization of use of military force that the president is utilizing is one that goes back several years. I think we're in a new and different engagement, and at the very least, I think there should be a vote. And I think that brings the issue not just of diplomacy but of strategy and the reality of what engagement the United States is going to have in particularly loss of life. When I was mayor of Manchester, I served when we lost a police officer in the line of duty. Last week was the 10-year anniversary of that death. And I gathered with the family of Manchester police officers and their supporters to honor Mike Briggs and to remember him. Those are moments that never leave your thoughts. I still remember that night when I was called like it was yesterday. And that was the worst day of my life. And this was not my family member that was lost. So imagine what it would be like to be his children, his wife, and his parents. But that was the worst day of my life. So as a member of Congress, I think the most critical decision a member of Congress is making, House or Senate, is sending one of our troops, men and women, into a battle, into harm's way, into war. So I said a few months ago that I think that there should be a vote. And I'd like to see that vote because I think it brings more attention to the reality of what's going on.
Well, do you have any sense of what the limits of the United States' involvement should be, how far the U.S. should go there?
Well, you know, part of the obligation of Congress is to properly fund a war effort. I still feel that the president has not provided a clear plan to end the engagement, to limit the threat of ISIS, and to address what I think is just absolutely inhumane in Syria. And so part of the challenge here is members of Congress, Republican and Democrat, should have an idea of what the end goal is. We're not looking for the specific line-by-line strategy. We certainly wouldn't want to telegraph that to our enemies. But there's a sense among members of Congress that the president is not complying with what would be a basic request of information prior to a vote occurring. My view is you need far more engagement from our allies in the region and around the world. We have to minimize the number of American troops. And by the way, that number is escalating unilaterally, not by authorization of Congress, but by decision of the president. That concerns me because we're talking about people who we talk as if they're not in the front line, but we had somebody killed today in the front line in trying to retake Mosul. So I would start with a clear plan to execute, to eliminate the threat, to retake Mosul, to absolutely ensure that the Iraqi fighters and other regional countries and other allies are engaging in this from a boots-on-the-ground perspective. And I think we can use alternative military and technical support and solutions from the United States. At some point, the United States cannot be the only country that is participating in a majority way. We can lead, but we don't have to be the only country with significant boots on the ground in every action.
So it sounds
like
you have real worries about the U.S. committing too many troops.
I do. I mean, I voted against the Libya action, and I you know was one of the few Republicans that did that because I take a very different perspective on this. I take this issue very seriously, and look, I want to defend our nation, and I want to defend our nation against terrorist activity, but I want to make sure that we do it in such a way that absolutely limits the loss of American life.
Coming up, we'll turn to guns and New Hampshire demographics. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Welcome back to our Conversations with the Candidates series on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Our guest is Congressman Frank Ginta. He's running for re-election in the 1st Congressional District. Next Thursday, we'll sit down with his Democratic opponent, former Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter. We're taking questions from our live audience, including members of the Concord Young Professionals Network, as well as those submitted in advance on social media. And Josh, let's start this segment off with a question from you, please.
Okay, let's turn to guns. Following the massacre in Orlando, there was bipartisan effort to enact so-called no-fly, no-buy laws, which would prevent people on the federal no-fly list from purchasing guns. Despite a lot of noise, nothing came of this, and according to polls, north of 80% of Americans back no fly, no buy. Where are you on this?
So first, let me say the Orlando tragedy never should have happened. 49 innocent people died. So Director Comey of the FBI at that point talked about the lack of resources that the FBI has, that there are cases in every state in the country that need to be followed, actively followed, and that he doesn't have the proper resources. As a member of Congress, that concerns me, and the first thing that we should be doing is, if that is true, that we should be increasing the funding that is necessary to prevent a situation like that. They had investigated this individual a number of times, but couldn't find a reason to deport that person. And as a result, we had 49 people die. As it comes to, look, I don't think any terrorists have any access to a weapon. One of the fundamental concerns I have is right now, if you walk into, if any American or citizen walks into a gun shop here in New Hampshire, anywhere in the country, and tries to buy a gun, you have to, a weapon of some sort, you have a federal and state background check that you need to go through. Right now, as we sit here, there are 48,000 cases of individuals who tried to do that. They failed the background check. The FBI was notified, which is a federal offense, and only 44 have been prosecuted by the Attorney General, by this and the current Attorney General. So we have a list of people who have broken the law, tried to access a weapon illegally, and our federal government is doing nothing about it.
But so where are you on no-fly, no-buy?
I don't want anyone to have access, any terrorist to have access to a weapon.
Would support such legislation?
Well, that current legislation was problematic in the sense that you had people like Ted Kennedy on the no-fly list. You have members of Congress on the no-fly list. You have military personnel on the no-fly list by accident.
I mean, I don't think Ted Kennedy is going to be attempting to buy a gun presently. I mean, you know.
Let's use a military, an individual who's employed by the U.S. military today, who is actually on the no-fly list by accident, who maybe wants to buy a weapon. That individual would not be allowed to. In principle, what I'm saying is, if you're a terrorist and you're identified as a terrorist, we should take every measure to ensure that you're not going to access the purchase of a weapon. But that list and that approach has been flawed. You can be put on that list for things that you wrote on your Facebook.
So if there was a process to, you know,
allow for
some
sort
of adjudication. Senator Ayotte, in her version of the bill that Susan Collins sponsored, you know, something she stressed was that there would be language that would.
But that is assuming that the process by which somebody gets on the list in the first place is reasonable. What I have looked at in because we were anticipating on having to vote on this legislation in the House, so I started doing research on it before the vote was coming up. It ultimately never failed in the Senate, so it never got to us in the House. But what I started to see is that this is a flawed system. So there can be a system in place where if you're a known terrorist that we have to ensure that you can't access a gun. But in addition to that, right now, there are people who are illegally trying to purchase guns. We have identified them because the owner of the gun shop immediately notifies the FBI, and the FBI is not prosecuting those individuals. That is leaving Americans unsafe knowingly, which is a great concern to me. So, you know, we've been reaching out to the U.S. Attorney General's office to see what they are going to do about at least prosecuting those individuals, because there are people that have been identified as people who are illegally trying to purchase weapons.
So on that same front, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has complained that it lacks the resources to enforce current laws. You say you'd be supportive of more resources for the FBI. Would that go for ATF as well?
Yeah, the way I would handle that, and I have talked to ATF and I've talked to DEA, both in this context and in the context of the heroin crisis. I went to the southern border back in April because 100% of the heroin coming to New Hampshire is crossing the southern border primarily due to three drug cartels. We're only interdicting 3-5%. Customs and Border doesn't have enough funding as well. So what I would like to do is an immediate accounting of what resources they have, what additional resources they're going to need, and then make that appropriation through the next budget process. But in order for that to work, the budget process has to work, and it hasn't been working over the last decade. So this year, we started undergoing over the summer hearings in the Budget Committee to improve the 1974 Budget Act, which hasn't had any real reform since 1974. So my hope is that We can have a better budget process where it actually works, it's effective, and you can get dedicated resources to these agencies based on a prioritization and based on a need. And my hope is that we start that within the next budget cycle next year.
Okay, I want to ask you about one piece of gun legislation you sponsored, which aimed to make it easier to buy handguns across state lines. What was the rationale for that?
Well, right now, if you visit New Hampshire, and you are a legal citizen, and you have, and you want to purchase a firearm, you can do it. It has to be shipped from that gun shop where the original purchase takes place, and you have to send it to a gun shop in your home state. In my view, there's no reason that you shouldn't be able to make that purchase and secure it and bring it home on your own. From an economic standpoint, so obviously the gun shops in New Hampshire do support that, but from an economic standpoint, we would see sales here in New Hampshire, and there would be a greater economic benefit to the state of New Hampshire as well. So we talked to a number of organizations to see, you know, if this was something that the state of New Hampshire would support, and we found that the people in New Hampshire want to be able to have that capability. So I did file the legislation, and I think it's the right thing to be able to let somebody, if you have a legal ability to under the Second Amendment to purchase a firearm, you should be able to do so.
Congressman Ginta, you talked about the importance of background checks and the 48,000 people who have failed background checks. Democrats have said that terrorists know about what they call a hole in our background check system, that while licensed official gun dealers do need to submit purchases to the background check system, smaller, private, you know, one-on-one people selling guns either at gun shows or online don't have to use that background check system. And they say terrorists can exploit that loophole and just buy a gun online. I wonder what you think about that. Should the background check system be extended to all sellers?
Well, essentially there is a process. If you're going to purchase a weapon online, you do have to go through a background check.
But even if it's a one-on-one purchase, you know, me to you?
You're supposed to go through a proper process, and if you don't, you could be liable. So,
so there are background checks for
there is a process, but there is a process by which.
But you oppose universal background checks, correct?
I'm not sure what you mean by universal.
Well,
we have background checks today.
Laura sells me a gun,
But we have background checks today. And I certainly don't support restricting or removing those requirements. I think there should be background checks for a whole host of reasons. But when you talk about terrorist activity or terrorism, I don't think you're seeing terrorist groups walk into a gun shop, you know, in New Hampshire or anywhere else trying to buy a gun. If they do, if there is one individual, that's why I brought up the issue of that background check occurring where that individual has been flagged, that gets sent to the Attorney General's office, and the Attorney General's office is not doing anything. They prosecuted 44 of the 48,000.
No, I get that. I'm asking about the smaller one-to-one private sales or the gun shows that, you know, happen on the weekends. Sometimes here in Concord, there's one at Everett Arena and so forth. Are background checks required for those types of sales?
In that circumstance, I would leave the current law as it exists today.
Which is what?
Well, you can make that purchase.
Without a background check.
I wouldn't change that.
So if I wanted to sell Josh a gun, I wouldn't have to check him out first. And make sure
he didn't give me a good price.
I believe you still, there's a process by which you have to have a bill of sale. You've got to show transfer of ownership of that weapon.
Congressman Ginta, we're going to move off of that and move on to a couple more questions, including one that came in from our audience. This person wanted me to read the question, so I'll share it with you. And thank you for the question. If it did occur, this person asks, how would you work with a Clinton administration? On what issues would you collaborate? And again, I want to thank that person for bringing that question forward.
Sure. I've said many times, regardless of who the next president is, I will work with that individual. There's a time to campaign and there's a time to govern. I think I exemplified over this last term that I've been able to work with this president. And look, I don't agree with the president on a lot of issues, but I was able to find common ground on six pieces of legislation. I don't think any member of Congress, Republican, can say that. Even on one of his signature issues, the Affordable Care Act, we were able to get him to understand and appreciate that the Cadillac tax was a negative impact to families, to communities, to small business owners, to the unions, as well as nonprofits and colleges and universities, and we were able to defer that with his signature for the next 2 years.
So that's so an area should it be
sure? Yeah, but the first thing that whoever the next president is that I will be working on is the next set of legislation for the heroin and opioid crisis, because that is not going away. It is eating away at families here in New Hampshire and across the country. Mr. Trump mentioned it during the debate last night, and I appreciate the fact that he did, because it demonstrates to me that even at this stage, you know, has an understanding and appreciation of the importance of that issue.
Yeah, something New Hampshire really brought to the presidential primary.
But if it's President Clinton, you absolutely believe that I will. I have an obligation as the people's representative to work on their behalf. And I feel I can work with anybody. I mean, I've been able to demonstrate that in my years of service.
Josh, back to you.
Sure. As you say, there's a time to campaign and a time to govern. So I want to ask you about how you're pitching yourself to voters these days. Why don't we listen to a little tape?
Look, I don't think anybody thinks that I am an insider or that I am part of the establishment. I think most people know that I have been fighting for principles that matter to families here in the state. I'm in my second term. I'm not a career politician.
All right. That was during the primary mm-hmm. debate. Perhaps you remember it.
I do.
You know, as we've discussed, you know, you've been on the outs with some in the Republican Party here, but you've been a state rep, you've been an alderman, you've been a mayor, you've been in and out of Congress. You were a congressional staffer. It's a lot of political experience. You know, we can argue about whether that makes you a career politician or not. But I guess what I want to know is why are you distancing yourself from that experience, at least, you know, publicly?
I mean,
one could argue it qualifies you for your job.
I'm not distancing myself from my own experience. I mean, I was a state. I talk about my days in the state house, which I think by most measurements, people would see that $100 a year job as public service, not, you know, as a career in politics. You know, the greatest lesson that you learn in Concord is really how to work collaboratively with people. The system in New Hampshire works, where you have citizen legislators. And then, you know, I had a passion for what was going on in my city, and it's decided to run for alderman. It's not a full-time job. It's not a political job. It's about service. So, when during the primary process I was accused of being a career politician, you know, look, I'm 46 years old. I'm serving my state. And I think most people in New Hampshire, regardless of party affiliation, do think about this as public service. And you know what, Josh? There were some people in my party that probably don't like my approach. Well, what matters to me is not the people in my party, but the people I represent. The people I represent is who I should take direction from, not people who identify themselves as party leaders. And that's a difference, and that's an important difference, because there are those who will run for office and then they take they do what their party leadership wants. I don't think that's the right way to govern or the right way to represent people. I have gone against my own party in certain circumstances. Libya was one. The budget process was another. Making sure that I had a bipartisan task force was a third. But people in the state, you know, some identified people that felt, you know, they didn't want me to support me. That's their opinion and they're entitled to it. But I tend to let the people speak for who they want representing them. And I think
right,
that
we're almost out of time, but I've got
passion.
To ask you one sure. final question. You know, it's the fall, the leaves are coming down, the days are coming shorter. It has become kind of a ritual, at least every other year in the First District of New Hampshire, to consider whether it's going to be Frank Ginta or Carol Shea Porter. And so, you know, I guess I'll ask you, do you ever feel trapped in some sort of political Mobius strip?
It's Groundhog Day all over again for me. You know, look, everybody has a right to run. And Carol Shea Porter has been running since 2006. And I've said you know, to put your name on a ballot is not an easy thing, and I respect her for doing that. We have different approaches on policy. We have different approaches on how we try to get things accomplished. But I think that people ultimately will look at what I've accomplished, the dedication, the heart, the passion that I place in this position. But this time people have a third alternative. They have, you know, Sean O'Connor. I mean, he was, you know, the self-identified progressive who supported Bernie Sanders. I think Carroll
sounds like you're glad he's in the race.
It's not that I'm glad. I mean, look, I mean, he was in a primary, and essentially he feels like he was kicked out of the head of his own primary. You know, that issue could have been resolved through the Democratic primary process. But I have always, going back to 2010, said that if you have legitimate candidates, they should be heard. This is New Hampshire. And in New Hampshire, we make sure that candidates get their voice.
Well, on that Groundhog Day question that Josh asked, we promise next week to ask Carol Shea Porter the same question. We'll hear what she says. And Congressman Ginta, I want to thank you very much
for being with us. Thanks for having me.
We really appreciate it. And that wraps it up for our conversation with 1st District Congressman Frank Ginta. A week from now, again, we'll talk to his Democratic challenger, Carol Shea Porter. Thanks to our listeners who turned out tonight to talk with Congressman Ginta. Thanks to all of you who submitted questions in advance. And again, to our guest, Congressman Frank Ginta. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.